And welcome. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you're listening to from. Welcome to Borderlines, the only show that takes you beyond borders. As you know, on this show we talk global politics, all global politics. Most of you seem to think all we do is talk about Israel and Palestine, but that is also because Israel and Palestine is actually shaping global politics in a big way than other issues are. Israel and Palestine. No, let me start again. I've said to people more recently, in the last couple of months at least, that October 7th, that dastardly act by Hamas on October 7th, is no longer about what Israel did with Palestine, or what Palestine did, or what Hamas did to Israel. October 7th has become a catalyst. It's become the biggest catalyst of change, certainly within the Israel Palestine issue since 1967. And then today, given global issues, October 7th has reshaped the minds of young people, the knowledge of young people, the confidence of the Palestinians, the risk, yes, risk to the Israelis, and by extension, the Jewry. When we say Jewry, we mean all the Jewish people across the world. Global Jewry. October 7th has opened up a space by which people are no longer afraid to speak their thoughts. But more importantly, when we say democracy, we often say free speech. What October the 7th and the offshoot and the layers and all the other factors that October 7th has created is that it is now questioning the West, and that's the global North, the Western Hemisphere. It is questioning what they really mean about free speech. Because it will appear the same region that has often lectured Africa and Africans and African leaders, past and present, about democracy, about free speech, about freedom. Freedom of press, freedom of journalism, the same hemisphere that has been encouraging the youth to speak up is now the same hemisphere that may actually not be so much about free speech. I want you to think about that as I introduce my guest. I have with me the CEO of Onicrop Consulting International. His name is George Ashiru. And George certainly knows a thing or two about what I'm talking about. And that's the conversation we're going to be having today. You, again, I ask you to bear in mind that even when we talk about Israel-Palestine, October 7th, by extension, we are. And that's why we talk about other regions. That's why we talk about Rwanda and all of, you know, Russia and all of that stuff. Because October 7th is a big factor today in the global news. Hello, George. How are you? Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much. How are you? I'm very well, thank you.
I'm good. I'm good, George. Thanks for joining. You heard my introduction. Any thoughts? Any extension? Do you agree, first of all, on the factor that October 7th is now a bigger factor than what it started off with?
Well, there is always that we have chemical reactions. There's always a catalyst. Mm. And a lot of people will ask you which comes first, the egg or the chicken. Mm-hmm. So it's the Israelis' reaction. It's the event of October 7th, the starting point of everything, or was it a culmination of something that had started before that.
Mm.
And is history repeating itself in cycles? Every few years, we have this conflict, which is between the oppressed people. Really, we have to be honest: the oppressed people of Palestine and the Israel as a nation, not even so much as a people.
The state of Israel,
right to. Yes, the state of Israel's right to exist in that same geographical location. So it's a lot of, I guess what is happening right now is it's a conversation. It's a bit like the conversation about Ukraine's right to exist because Russia believes Ukraine is a part of it. And so there's a lot of this opportunity for the world to actually know the history of this conflict. And for you to solve them, you have to get to the roots of those issues.
Indeed. So, we've started on a very important place, should I say. I'm going to put you on the spot then, even though you're thinking, Rita, we've only just started. What are you doing with me? But you make a good point, or you mentioned the right to exist. And it's a question that's becoming louder and louder. Does Israel have the right to exist? What do you think?
Of course. Every nation state has a right to exist. The question is, you have the right to exist in the context of your neighborhood or the geographical location. So do white people have a right to exist in South Africa? It's a question. You know, do Arabs have a right to exist in North Africa? Knowing fully well that, North Africa, historically belonged to a certain types of people, the Kushites. So essentially, historically, people have migrated and moved from one place to the other. And it's a subject of your next interview, by the way.
Mm.
And so when there's a critical mass of movement, then there is a struggle. And we see that even in the north of Nigeria.
Mm.
We see that in places where there are settlers and then there are the indigenous people. And there is a struggle for, how do we meander our way to be able to benefit from the resources of this place, even though we don't come from here. But in the case of Israel, Israel has historically had the right to exist there. But the issue is Palestine and those who are people who are residing in the Palestinian areas, they also have the right to exist there. And that's why the whole world has been speaking about a two-state solution. So the question for Israel as a state is the same problem Russia faces, that I don't want to have countries around me that are pro-NATO.
Mm.
So Israel is scared that all of these lands are going to be filled up with people who don't want us to exist. So we need to take charge. We need to take over. And in a way, we can't give them the right to exist, because then that will give them the rights to their budget and to their weapons, to be able to do whatever it is they want to do against us. What the world needs to do now is an opportunity for the world's best negotiators to get involved. But I guess the leaders of both parties, that is the Prime Minister of Israel and the leaders of Hamas, are extremely stubborn people. They don't seem to want to sit down to talk about the very credible, obvious solution that United Nations supports, which is let there be a people that exists and run their own governments, take their own taxes, and have a right to be there as a nation state.
Interesting. Now, this is the thing. So the Palestinians, going by what you've said, the average Palestinian will say to you, we don't have a problem with Israel existing. Israel is the one that has a problem with our existence. Israel is the one that's encroaching on our sovereignty and pretty much stopping us from being a sovereign nation via the support of the US. They will say to you, Israel took away our airports in 2006, all because Jewish people moved out, Jewish Israelis rather, moved out of Gaza. They will say to you, Israel controls our lights, our water, controls our lives. They will even tell you, Israel controls the amount of calories that we consume in Gaza. So then, if we have the right to exist, why is that not the primary focus of the world? Why is the primary focus always about Israel? And I guess when we say the world, we talk about America and the American allies. What would you say to that?
Well, you see, that belabors the point again that we are mostly talking about the surface and not dealing with the root of the problem. Now, Israel's greatest concern that it has enemies that those enemies are people, may not necessarily be Palestinians, but there is a group called the Hamas, who are funded and controlled by an enemy state called Iran, as far as Israel is concerned. So the question for Israel is, what guarantees does it have that when a state that is right next to its border exists, it will not legitimately allow the, in quote, terrorists to come into the territory and launch attacks at them, which is happening in Yemen, which is happening in so many other places. So this, you see, again, like you said, if you go into Israel today, you find Arabs living comfortably in Israel. You'll find Palestinians living comfortably in Israel who are citizens of Israel. So we have to differentiate between the...
But those Arabs would actually... I have been to Israel, and even when I spoke to them, they will say to you, we live... Yes, we live here, but we live in apartheid because we don't have the rights that Jewish Israelis have, even though we're Arab Israelis. I spoke to a few young people when I was in Israel.
It's a different matter altogether. And the reason it's a different matter, in fact, it is linked in a way, because the issue with the Jews is the fact that they believe that the average Arabs want them exterminated. So the kind of freedom you give people who you believe are looking for your extermination has to be with one eye open and one eye closed. Mm. Some 16 years ago, 17 years ago, I got a chance to go to South Africa. And while we were gathering, and having these events, apparently, there was a call from the then president of Nigeria, Obasanjo, to somebody in that group. And we got that together and they said, of something going on in Nigeria. What was it? The president was complaining that there was some kind of terrorist attack on his helicopter. And then the white people were saying, oh, by the way, if you are so concerned, you should also be concerned about our president here, Nelson Mandela. We said, why? I had met Mandela when he first came out in 1990, so I was interested in knowing the story. And they said, well, the fear they have is that even though they are South Africans, but if Mandela dies, who is a pacifist president, the chances are that the blacks will want to overrun the whites. Mm. So again, you see that minority problem, minority that have the power, the minority that has the control of the government and the resources, always feeling that we're not safe here. So it was because Mandela was able to get his own party, ANC, to guarantee the security and the safety of the whites through the electoral process, because he became president and now ANC controls government. And the whites said, no problem, you can control government, just don't disturb us. Is that kind of peace that is required now? Is it not the same South Africa that's fighting for the Palestinians now? Because they understand, they've been through it. So, and by the way, 35 years ago, Palestinians were in Nigeria, sponsored by Nigerian government.
Indeed, yes.
To Nigerian universities.
Yes.
You know, while I was at the University of Lagos, we had some of them who were here, also from Equatorial Guinea. So lots of countries have done everything to support Palestinians one way or the other. Can you think back to 35 years ago? And now the problem still exists. So it means that there's either some hypocrisy at the international level, you know, when it comes to lip service, when it comes to this matter, or it's so deeply rooted that the kind of transformational leaders that can sit down and have that conversation are not yet existing in both sides of the equation.
George, I'm so glad I've got you here. Unpacking is an understatement. So let's talk about that hypocrisy. Is America the hypocrisy in chief or the hypocrite in chief in this situation?
No. I am not going to mention names of states or countries. Everybody really tries to protect itself. Every nation will be self-centered and selfish when it comes to things like that. So for whatever reason, there's a lot of Jews in America, a lot of investment in America. So American politics, American economics has a lot of direct influence in what's going on in Israel. And by the way, America and the rest of the, in quote, G7 world were the ones that guaranteed and created that state for Israel after the wars in 1947. So they have a duty, just like they have a duty to Japan, they have a duty to Korea, to protect these nations, you know, after the whatever kinds of wars created, civil wars, you know, amongst them, is the same thing they have with Israel right now. However, we see, you know, over this past several decades that every single American president has wanted and suggested a two-state solution. The current president, Obama as a president, even Donald Trump, you know, as a president, they've all come to the conclusion that the permanent solution is that these people must exist as a nation state. But nobody has been able to identify how they can get Hamas and Hezbollah and these other groups that are not necessarily the nation state. They are not a country. They are just a group of people within the states who have some sort of antagonism for the existence of that country called Israel. So until, and again, that is the reason why Israel claims it's fighting this war nonstop, that we must completely get rid of Hamas before we can feel safe enough to say, look, you can run your country the way you want. Now, the problem is, who controls Hamas? Who funds them? Why are they not in the table discussing? You understand? Because every war ends in negotiation. So I think that's another question that I believe United Nations has to really ask itself. Why don't we agree to discuss with these people? Why simply say they are terrorists? And as long as you have listed them as terrorists, you cannot negotiate with them. Fact of the matter is that because they exist, 35,000 people have died. And they will become 100,000 in 6 months if they're not careful. So the need for, again, a transformational leadership at the topmost level of nations in this world must have the political will to get these people together and say, look, we don't know who's right, who's wrong, but we need to talk.
So here's the thing. We need to talk. Indeed. Here's the thing. The talk is happening, right? Hamas is negotiating. Israel is negotiating. Qatar is in between both of them, and so a couple of other Arab states, right? Israel is now at this stage offering 40-day ceasefire and release of all the hostages. Hamas, incidentally, and I have to correct you, Hamas is a politically, democratically elected group. They're not an imposed group. They're not an anti-state group. They were democratically elected in the elections in Palestine in 2007 or so, right? 2000, yes, they were. George, please check. They were. In fact, what it is Hamas won the Gaza. The Palestinian Authority won the West Bank. In fact, they both politically fought each other, and Hamas even ended up encroaching into the space of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. The latest poll from the Middle East, so this is the from Palestine, which is the poll that came out on the 31st of March, right? Still states that the majority of Palestinians support Hamas. As that's just, I'm just stating it for you. 2007. Now, let me go back to what you were saying. The ceasefire, which, like I said, Israel is offering a 40-day ceasefire and a release of all their hostages. Okay? Hamas is saying, we don't want a 40-day ceasefire. We want a permanent ceasefire. We want Israel out of Gaza. Okay, and we want all our hostages back. Israel, there are 132, I believe, 132 Israeli hostages still under the Hamas captive. There are some 4,000 to 7,000 Palestinians under Israeli captive. So you see where the friction is. So what is that way forward? Because this is where they are. Hamas is saying we want permanent. Israel is saying I want to offer you 40 days, release my hostages, and I'm still going to go into Rafah. So what's the way forward? If you were advising them, George, or you were advising the United Nations, perhaps not even Israel or Hamas, what would the United Nations have to do?
The bottom line still remains that we are talking about the symptoms of a problem, not the root of the problem.
Well, the root, let's talk about the root of the problem. The root of the problem is apartheid, it's occupation, it's all of that stuff, 1948, right?
I am neither a Palestinian nor an Israeli, so I'm not going to take sides.
Asking you about the root of the problem.
The issue objectively.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, so my objective truth concerning what is going on there, mm-hmm. which we have all grown up seeing since we were young,
mm-hmm.
again, is that nobody is guaranteeing the statehood of Palestinians and nobody's guaranteeing the security of Israel. That's the root of the problem. So different groups have existed over time, and they've all become, all of them, one way or the other, have become terrorist organizations, so supporters of terrorist organizations. They might take over government, they might win political elections, but their behavior has tended towards what then has made America list them as terrorist organization. And that's the terminology I'm using. But again, like I'm saying, those things will exist as long as the problem remains. You see, there is no revolution without a cause. There is no problem. When there is peace, there's something that the former president of Nigeria, Ibrahim Babangida, said. He said, a coup cannot succeed except the plotters create a state of instability. People must want change because things are not tenable. So the things are not tenable. When they are not tenable, it will create groups like the Hamas, like Hezbollah. Things are not tenable. So why are we, look at Europe. Let's give a classic example. There was a Nazi Europe. What did Europe do? They came together. They sorted the problem out. That they created a union called the European Union. So why can't they do the same thing in the Middle East? Why is it so difficult for people to sit down to say, okay, you know, there was a time Germany was at war against England and against Italy and against France, but now Germany and France and Italy are part of the same bloc working together. So something happened, they sat down, you know, and it was all triggered by Gorbachev saying, look, you know what, we're not going to have a grip against Eastern European nations anymore. Let everybody exist the way they want to exist. So everybody was released from the Soviet Union. And because of that, they were able freely to live wherever they wanted to live. And all the problems were solved. There was no more Nazism. There was no more. Now people can move from one state to the other. The same thing could exist in the Palestinian areas. You could create a situation where Jews feel so relaxed, they will say, look, we don't even need visa to come into Israel. A Palestinian can come into Israel. We can go into Gaza. We can go to the West Bank. We can go to Golan Heights. We don't have to worry. Why? Because you have created an environment, an ecosystem where everybody feels, okay, now we're working together. But if you cannot create it, we are going to go through this cycle where you release hostages today, there is a temporary peace, give them another 4 years, another group of people will get up, they still feel pinched, they still feel unhappy, they still feel something is not quite right, their freedoms are not right, they feel poverty is still speaking, 70%, 80% poverty rate, and they believe that is because one nation has surrounded them and pinched their opportunities. And then before you know it, another intifada will start.
Okay, so if...
So we shouldn't be worried about this, but having a conversation around about how many people are in the various cells or detentions, or how many people are in jail in Israel. Those are the symptoms of the root of the problem. We need the United Nations Security Council to call a world conference on this matter where there will be an agreement by all the nations of the world to support the existence of a state for the Palestinians, a state for Israel, and a guarantee of the security of Israel.
But the United Nations calls for that. There is a vote. There's a resolution. America vetoes it. Now, you say you don't want to call out. Well, I'm going to call out America because, incidentally, when people of the global south are afraid to call out America for what America is. The children of America right now are telling America, you are hypocrites in chief. So it goes back to that thing. You talked about the collective, right? The collective union of a region. That's why we have the Abraham Accord, right? They already got together to create the Abraham Accord, right?
Yes.
Now, America has been working tirelessly to normalize relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia, okay, based on the Abraham Accord. but nobody's including the Palestinians. This is part of the problem, which is why, and then also we have to go back to the fact that we can't ignore that there are innocent people in prison. Whatever peace looks like, peace has to include people. Whatever the two-state solution looks like, people must always come first. Innocent Israelis were kidnapped, were killed on October 7th, right? They are yet to get over that. And innocent Palestinians have been getting kidnapped by Israel for decades. So we've there has to be that space where, you know what, you shake my hand, I shake your hand. This is yours, this is mine, now let's sit down. And that's why I think everybody's working on this ceasefire. Because if there's no ceasefire in Gaza, right, until that ceasefire is done.
What happened to Allah?
Go ahead.
Do you know what happened to Anwar Sadat? Do you know what happened to Anwar Sadat, the late president of Egypt? He was assassinated for making peace with Israel.
Mm.
So this is
so was the former president, prime minister of Israel. He was assassinated for making peace with Palestine.
This is exactly the point I'm trying to make, that there are strong-minded people on both sides who deeply, thoroughly are fearful of each other, that any attempt whatsoever. Now, let's go back again to history. Mahatma Gandhi, why was he assassinated? Essentially for encouraging the breakaway of Pakistan from India. So there are lots of people in these organizations, in these states, in these countries that have very strong views about the other party. So the concern that I have is that while we are so focused on solving the immediate issue, which is to stop the war, we think that we have gotten some kind of victory the moment we get the war over or Israel stops bombing Israel, not knowing that we are just sowing seed for a greater conflict in the future. So, yes, there will always be America, you know, vetoing resolutions that are agreed by Security Council. But you see, it's the consistency of it over the years that has political problems, or even presidents that veto it. These children in America that are protesting, they're also telling the president, we're not likely to vote for you. So there's a political cost for every veto that you use. And so as long as there's a generation ready to get up to say, look, we're going to fight for the interests of these people. As long as there are young Jews who are interested in the welfare of the Palestinians, young Palestinians who are interested in the security of Israel, these old folks and crooks and wherever they are, hopefully, you know, they will leave the scene, and newer people with more transformational thinking will be able to sit down. Now, is that possible? From a purely political point of view, I will be realistic to say, I don't see it happening in the next 10, 15 years. But then, we never thought a black man would be president of America either. So anything can happen.
Okay, I'd like to talk about global crisis now, moving beyond Israel. This has been such an interesting conversation, moving beyond Israel and Palestine. There's a growing migrant crisis across the world. Whether it's Africa, whether it's Eastern Europe, there is a growing migrant crisis. Who would you say, or what would you say is responsible for that?
There's nothing wrong with migration. Humankind has been migrating from the foundations of the world. Christians who look in the Bible, the first migration happened with Abraham. You know, leave your all of the Chaldeans and go to a niche, go to a place that I will show you. So there has never been a time when people did not move. Now, one of the reasons why people move is for geographical reasons. If you live in a place that is arid and desert areas and you're not able to feed your children, you will look for where there's forest and foliage. If you live too far away from the waters and you need to travel, you will want to move to where the waters are. So naturally, when you move, you are going to meet people already there before you, and conflicts will come up. So migration has been a part of human history. But the real basis for that is what I mentioned, is that people always move because there is a need that they don't have where they are presently located.
Mm.
Now, modern migration is almost purely economic. Almost purely economic. People are moving because they have skill sets that they believe are needed somewhere else, or they are not able to survive with the current skill set they have where they are, so they need to go to where they will be able to survive with what they have.
Mm.
So there's a lot of that going on all over the world. There are Indians have been migrating since when I was young. They were all over Africa. There was a time Ghanaians were all over Africa and they were teaching us here 40, 50 years ago. And then they moved back. And then Nigerians are now going to other countries. The least migrated nations in this world, people, are the Japanese, the Koreans, the people from Luxembourg, from Monaco. Why? Because they are wealthy nations. Singapore, where you have income per capita of $50,000 plus. Mm. Why would they want to go elsewhere when the income per capita is $20,000? Except they are going for higher quality jobs, or they go for missionary work. So I don't think there's a problem with migration. I have a feeling that the reason migration is important is because it carries with it also disruption in the lives of the people moving. With that, disruption can be positive, but it can also be negative.
No, but my question is even, what is driving this migration? Because we've never had so much migration as we have today across the world. And let's be torn, we're putting it nicely when we say migration, illegal migration, dangerous migration, people actually risking their lives to get away from war-torn areas, to get away from areas that have been affected by climate change, economic reasons, etc. Young people, families. Yet, these same people are running to countries that should be giving them safe havens, but they're not getting it. They are being treated in a hostile manner. And that's why I'm asking, perhaps I should change my question. Do you think those countries are responsible? They have a responsibility to actually take in these migrants, given that they are leaders of the world?
No. No country has a specific duty to take everyone from all over the world. The job of each government is to protect and secure its own borders,
mm-hmm.
protect and secure its own people. And then if you have, on a humanitarian basis, if there is war or famine or earthquake or a reason where a group of people migrating, then you can open up your borders in a very, very organized way for them to come in, usually temporarily, grant them asylum, allow them to stay until they are able to get themselves together and back to where they came from.
Yes, but migrants rarely do that, George. Let's look at what's happening in the UK now, right? So the UK government is now shipping its problems, and I have to call it its problems, to Rwanda. And Rwanda is willing to accept it, right?
Yes.
But the migrants are saying they don't want to go to Rwanda, right? America has a problem on its border with South America.
You don't have a right to live in another man's country.
Mm.
It's not your country. So it is their humanitarian principles that allow people to say, you cannot come in. But if they feel that we cannot accommodate you, it is their duty to return you. See, we would have the same problem in Nigeria if suddenly everybody from Mali and Niger started to move into our borders. We're already facing it with our security situation. And so what would happen is that any safe government would say, no, we do not want migration on the borders anymore. We don't want people coming because of ECOWAS and bringing the insecurity, bringing guns, bringing whatever it is that their terminologies are. So the key thing really is safe migration. So if a nation does not feel that migrants that are coming are going to bring into it the right kind of positive impact, then that's not safe migration for them. They will obviously ship you back. On the other hand, they can open up their borders through these highly skilled projects, highly skilled manpower projects, educational routes that we have in the UK and other nations, where they believe that, look, we have a need. and we look for 100,000 people over the next 5 years, yes, you can come in through that route. But you can't come in with a gun. You can't come in with knives. You can't come in and say, well, since I could not survive in my country, I will come here and hope that I could carry on with my crimes. So I don't have a problem with safe borders. I don't have a problem with people securing their borders. I am with the Americans. I don't really want to say which party or the other, who believe that they have to secure their borders. That's the first thing you do. When you secure your borders, then your people are safe. It's the same issue we're talking about in Israel. If you do not feel safe where you are, and the reason you're not safe is because people you do not know, undocumented migrants, people who don't know where they came from, they will come and cause disruption in your society. The issue we really critically have is bad leadership in many nations. Wars in many nations, because it's all down to leadership. Why do we have wars? Terrible leadership. Why are we having war in Gaza right now? Because the two leaders cannot sit and talk together. So when we have this terrible leadership, then we have wars, we have conflicts, and we have challenges, and the ordinary people have to migrate from where they are to run away from those that crisis or whatever those kinds of crises are. So I think one of the things we need to do, and I think NAPTIP and UN migration agencies, I think one of the conversations they've been having of recent is that how do we ensure that when people migrate, they are migrating in an orderly manner, they are properly taught, you know, where they are going, how to integrate themselves, how to live well, so they are prepared and they can go. And they're not purely economic migrants. They are not kidnapped. What do you call them? What's that phrase that we use for?
You mean that they're not trafficked? Trafficked.
Yeah, human trafficking.
Yeah.
Human trafficking is the biggest problem we have in Nigeria and sub-Saharan Africa. Human trafficking is a negative type of migration that we're talking about. And again, some of the people migrating, because I had an opportunity to be involved in one of these events, most of the people are migrating because somebody told them that there's an opportunity, not because they were not doing well here. Somebody simply told them, oh, there's a greater opportunity, so why don't we go there and let's go through this route. A lot were deceived. They will come back and tell you, I didn't know that I was going to be deceived. I was living well before. I was doing very well before. They told me there was a greater lifestyle, this greater standard of living where I was going. So it's a very interesting subject. But I think that we should not always look at it from the point of view that it's the responsibility of certain countries to open up their borders for everybody to come into their countries. No.
Okay. But I'm going to put you on the spot. Let's go back to our history. Transatlantic slave trade built those countries, right? Again, do those countries, the same countries that came here and took the loot and the people to work that loot from here, from the Caribbean, from other parts of Africa, to build their own country, which eventually became a superpower. Do they not owe a responsibility to the countries that they've looted? Is that what you're saying?
No. You see, even if we decide to go into the history of wars and so on and so forth, we've done that to ourselves in Africa as well. You know, we've got empires that have entered other tribes and destroyed them and killed them and taking their children and women to slavery. We've done that to ourselves. Going back by what you're saying, that there's a duty of some of these nations to do some kind of reverse reparation by opening up their borders and let everybody in. I do not subscribe to that fact, because then your own nation has to sign that kind of bilateral agreement that allows anybody from anywhere to enter your territory in the same way. I think that it is unfortunate that we had a period in our history where people were forcibly taken away from their homes, or that our people even sold their own people into slavery. However, we do not need to go back to that past in order to fix the problem. What we need to do is fix our economies, fix our infrastructure, fix our government, create prosperity for the people, create economic opportunity for the people, and they will not want to leave. They will not. Have you noticed that South Africans hardly move? How many South Africans do you know in Lagos? They hardly leave their country. Because one way or the other, they are sub-Saharan, but they've got the strongest economy, the greatest productivity.
They did have.
And highest...
They did have.
Number of millionaires.
They did have. Look, George, when I was in the UK, when I was growing up in the UK, of course I met South African economic migrants. They might not go through the boats like our people did or like our people do, but certainly there were South African economic migrants. And today, if you go to the townships, you ask them if they want to get out of that place, they will put their hands up quicker than you can spell South Africa.
But part of the matter is they will not leave, because every nation that they look at to go to, the standard of living in their country is better.
Okay.
So if they think, let me come to Nigeria, they have 24 hours electricity, then they will come to Nigeria and say, it's only 6 hours. I thought it was better in Lagos. So all those movies I was watching is all fake. They will go back to their country now. When they realize that they can't even get the basic infrastructure they are so used to in their country that's been provided through whatever kind of apartheid system, they will look and make comparisons and realize that, look, we're living in a mini Europe here. We might as well stay. You know, our currency is more stable. I'm not saying they don't have the poor amongst them. Yes, indeed, there were South Africans in England. When I was schooling in England as well, I had South Africans who were there. White South Africans, by the way, who ran away. But a lot of them ran away because of the pressure on the apartheid regime as well. Mm. Not purely because of their... They had richer... They were more connected to their European roots, and they felt safer. So they ran. Again, that's probably not economic, but they also ran because they also had fear for their lives. So I think overall, we have to be responsible with the idea of migration. We're not saying there shouldn't be migration. We're simply saying there should be some kind of responsibility. And above all, there should be an effort for these nations to invest back to where the root of the migration is. So what the British government is doing, saying they want to move people to Rwanda, is very irresponsible. The reason I say it's irresponsible is that you have taken people from all over Africa, from different states, simply because they said they are asylum seekers and they probably don't have passports. You have an agreement with the Rwandan government that will give you $2-5 billion or pounds, and then you can keep them. But from what will they do in Rwanda? They will get Rwandese passport after a while, and they will migrate again. So you are just recycling the crap.
Absolutely.
So I don't think that's a good solution. But what they could do is to say, where are all these people coming from? What is the problem in those nations? How can we resolve some of those problems? And unfortunately, our governments are not helping matters with corruption and all the other things.
Oh, George, I'm having a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. Right. Who is going to rebuild Gaza? Let's go back to the Middle East. Who is going to rebuild Gaza, given the destruction and devastation that has blanketed Palestine right now?
Who's going to fix the war in the Middle East? They need a new leader.
Well, not so much the Middle East. Who is going to rebuild Gaza? Is Israel? Does Israel have the responsibility as the occupier? Remember, they're the occupier. Do they have the responsibility to rebuild Gaza, or is that the job of the rest of the Arab nations?
I think it's not fair to put responsibility on just one of the key stakeholders. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a conversation amongst all of them. And by the way, most of those Arab nations have a better relationship with Israel. So clearly, they get along with Israel for whatever reason. And that could be because of years and years and years of seeing that they need to coexist. And they're doing trade with one another. So, but the sticking point is, they don't all seem to know what to do with the issue of Gaza, because the Hamas that is as the leader or the leading organization in Palestine right now, they are aligned with an enemy of the Arab states. They are aligned with Iran, which is an enemy of the Arab states. So that makes it difficult even for the Arab nations to come together to say, we want to support you, but we don't know if supporting you means helping Iran having an upper hand in this area. So it's, like I said, it's a complex series of issues that we are avoiding by focusing on the crisis, but not the causes.
Okay.
The causes.
I can take your calls. I know some of you have been wanting to call 0700-993-993-993-0201-465-7190. Or have you sent a message to the WhatsApp 0809-597-5805. We are streaming live on Facebook and YouTube. Yep, and the lines are coming now, George. We only have 10 minutes, so when you call, please, your name, where you're calling from, and your question, please. I will give you 30 seconds because we have to give George the time to respond. Hello? Hello? Yes, good afternoon, Koboko. Go ahead. Thank you.
I want to tell you my opinion. The causes of migration, number one, bad government. Number two, unequal rights. Number three, injustice. Nigerians don't have business in going away after we have 44 natural resources. But because of the insensitive bad rule that are not harnessing it and share it equal, that is why Nigerians are suffering.
Thank you.
Are you hearing me?
Thank you.
So my friend, he went to Dubai.
No, I can't take that. Koboko, we don't have time. Everybody's getting 30 seconds.
Okay.
Thank you for your comment. Hello? Okay. Right. So let me come back to you, George. We spoke about Gaza, but we haven't talked about the West Bank and the settlers. What are your thoughts on the Israeli settlers who even the United Nations has said they are violent settlers who continue to encroach on Palestinian land, who are supported by the Israeli government? How do you propose they are dealt with? Because we've spoken about Hamas, but nobody really, the settlers are hardly spoken about, although America just said they're going to throw sanctions at a handful of them. But there are now over 700,000, or is it 700 settlers around the West Bank, which has shifted. Israel's border from 1967 no longer exists because the border has been broken. I'm going to give you a minute because now everybody's calling. Can you sort of talk to that very quickly?
I think there's an agreement all over the world that the settler.
No, not now. Network.
It's untenable and unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's clear to everyone that nobody appreciates when you encroach on other people's lands. You know, just because Israel had won these wars and therefore taken over these lands as a buffer, it was initially meant to be. They've now decided that, look, we're going to essentially acquire these lands permanently as ours. Now, that is not what any single government in this world accepts. But again, Israel keeps coming up with this idea that it's for our security, and nobody is able to deal with the issue of what do you call security? What constitutes security for Israel? Is it that a 10-mile border, a 5-mile border, a 2-mile buffer zone is what you call security? But in this day, when the technology is by drone, it doesn't matter anymore. You know, rockets are flying. What they did 70 years ago is no longer tenable. You know, the idea of people rushing into the border to come and shoot at them, they can simply send rockets. So I think there's a need for that conversation. It's a very, very, very unfortunate thing that other people's lands are. You know, I've just said now that I fight for the right to keep your border safe. So I do not like the idea of anybody encroaching on my border. If I was a president, I will totally defend the territory of this nation or any nation in which I'm a leader of.
Okay, thank you.
Encroach border beyond yours is not illegal. Israel has not done well when it comes to that.
Thank you. Hello? Hello?
Hello, good afternoon. It's Yogi.
Good afternoon. What's your name and where are you calling from? And your question very quickly. Please.
Yeah, I also greet your guest.
Yes.
This is the merchant man.
Yes.
The question I want to ask is on the insistence of Israel in making sure they want to invade Rafah, which purportedly seems as the last stronghold of the Hamas.
Mm.
If at the end of the day, Rafah eventually falls, how does Israel now, because by the time Rafah falls, It means the war is like it has ended. How does Israel now see the rest of the citizens of the Palestine?
Do they see them
as pussies and panties of the war? That's my question.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Merchantman. Wait, George, you got that. I'll just pick up a second one so you can answer. Hello.
Hello, Elizabeth.
Good evening. Your name and where you're calling from, and your question, please. Very quickly, 30 seconds. Sorry?
You have to fill up on the line. I want to be it with our guest. First of all, I don't agree that some of the things that are called migrations are. Some of them is the selfish interest of the powerful. For instance, the UK, the Americas, the net, all of them. The problem they cause in Gaddafi's country. Is responsible for some of them. They will go other places and induce violence there. And I don't know, what do you have? So I think the double standard, and I'm happy that young people in America today are standing up against the hypocrisy that has been there for a very long time.
Thank you.
So if this hypocrisy, look at what is happening in the UK again today. The Labour won election how many days ago now? Look at this. So the injustice can never last forever.
Mm.
You cannot be on the one side calling yourself champion of justice or whatever
all over
the world, yet you are being hypocritical and doing unjust things.
Thank you, Okoyemi. Right, George, over to you. I'm going to give you 2 minutes to respond to both. You heard the first question, and you may wish to respond to Okoyemi. You have 2 minutes starting now, because we're running out of time.
Yeah. Well, there is obviously Israel has a strategic reason for wanting to go into Rafah. It's a purely military reason. They want to control all the areas where there's a movement or opportunity for logistics supplies. They want to break the supply chain of their own enemies. But by so doing, they are also inflicting pain on the people of that region. The entire region, the whole of Palestinian territory is on fire as we speak. I think that we do have opinions, and our opinions count. It's for our government to hear the opinion of the citizens. I think Nigeria should be careful when we are going to United Nations to support what is obviously not right, what is obviously injurious to the people in that region. While we see that there is a necessity to secure Israel, we must also say that the rights of the people to exist in the land they've been for thousands of years must also be sacrosanct.
Mm.
And I think that is what it is. There's nothing we can do in Nigeria about Israel's decision, but our government, if they are hearing us, they can take a stand and talk to the ambassador about this is what Nigerians think and this is how we think you should go about it.
Okay.
Then as far as the migration issue is concerned, yes, we do have, I've been to Libya myself, and I know Libya was peaceful when Gaddafi was there. And then America decided that it was in their own interest to get rid of the man, and the rest of it is what we're affecting the Sahel region, even it comes to the north of Nigeria today. And that obviously creates the kind of crisis that we're experiencing in this country. So we do not all agree, and I don't think any Nigerian even agrees with the actions of the West when it comes to their interference in the internal matters of so many nations in their own economic or strategic interests.
Mm.
So the key thing for us is that let's build our nation. Let's secure our borders. Let's build our economies. Let's get good leadership. Let's vote the right people so that we can at least, and then we're not so what's going on in other nations around us or what's going on 10,000 miles away from us affecting us here in Nigeria.
Thank you.
Look at what's going on with wheat. Because of the war in Ukraine, it's affecting the price of products in Nigeria. We need to fix those sort of things
so that
we can become a strong, vibrant country called Nigeria.
George Ashiru, thank you so much. I now understand better when you said, look, I'm a neutral. I'm just going to say it as it is. Thank you for coming on Borderlines to say it exactly as you see it. Much appreciated. Especially your thoughts on the migration issue. It's very uncommon in this country.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Have a nice evening.
You too.